Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I'm very excited about the program that we're going to have today with a veteran of both the U.S. Army and the United States Air Force. He has quite a story to tell. In the course of this hour, we're going to hear about the incredible souvenir that he brought with him to the Valley this week and some of the harrowing experiences that he endured as a soldier and as a prisoner of war during World War II. Glenn Schmidt, my guest today. And Glenn, I know you live in Folsom, outside of Sacramento now, but growing up, you were a Valley guy, a Fresno area guy in Reedley, right?
Yes, sir.
So is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about what you remember from that day.
It was a Sunday afternoon. A group of us gathered for lunch after church. We went up to Washington School to play softball. And that's when we heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese. And, of course, at that time I was a senior in high school, 17 years old. I really didn't know much about Pearl Harbor, and in fact, I'm sure none of us did.
Did it hit you that this was a huge deal and was probably going to impact your life?
It only took a day or so, because the very next day, and was Monday, we gathered together in the auditorium at Reedley High School when we heard President Roosevelt speak to us about the day that lived in infamy.
And how long was it from there until you ended up working for Uncle Sam?
I enlisted October the 1st, 1942.
And was there a reason that you enlisted in the Army as opposed to another branch of service?
I did enlist in the Army Air Corps at that time.
Mm-hmm. With the dream of being a pilot?
No, not really. I didn't know what I would be doing. However, I was, after I enlisted at Fort MacArthur, Southern California, I was sent up to what was then Merced Army Flying School at Merced, which later became Castle Air Force Base.
And you would spend some time there later in the Air Force, long after World War II, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. So you had this thought that you would be in the U.S. Army Air Corps, that you would be far from the front lines on the ground, and I guess, as things would have it, turned out a little differently for you.
It certainly did.
Tell me about that. How did things change?
After basic training, became a link trainer instructor. And being a link trainer instructor, we trained young pilots in basic flying training, learning to fly at night under cloudy and hazardous conditions. That was my calling. I enjoyed every bit of it until an opportunity came to apply for the Army Specialized Training Program, which was a college engineering course.
Mm-hmm.
And after signing up for that, I was sent to Illinois College at Jacksonville, Illinois, for a period of several months until such time as the need for infantrymen became acute in the Army. And that was all broken up, and every one of us who at that time were college students learning basic engineering were sent to various infantry divisions.
And what was that like for you at the time, realizing it? And here you're in this ASTP program, you're doing something special, you have this great ambition, and they say, no, you're going to be a grunt on the ground because that's where we need you.
Yes, definitely. Well, I had no idea what the infantry would be like. And at that time, I was young enough to accept any challenge. And as a result, I was trained as an infantryman, a combat infantryman, which I was then to become, not knowing that that would be the end result.
Was that difficult training for you? Was it a brand new thing to you? Was it anything you'd had any kind of experience with?
No, sir. Basic training in the Air Force or Army Air Corps was very light, just a couple of months learning how to march step and things of that nature. I was had not fired a weapon in training at all until I became an infantryman. They handed me a Browning automatic rifle, which fired a clip of 20 rounds. The BAR weighed 21 pounds at that time, plus either a bandolier or a a belt full of 20-round clips for my BAR.
And how much did you weigh?
I weighed at that time about 145.
So you're carrying around a pretty good percentage of your body weight in extra equipment.
Yes, sir. And 25-mile hikes with something like that on your back, plus a full field pack, I can tell you is not a very endearing experience.
But it toughened you up a little bit.
It sure did.
And you were going to need it by the time the war was over.
Yes.
Tell me about the unit that you ended up getting assigned to and what your first impression was of the men that you would end up serving with.
I was assigned to the 1st Squad, the 1st Platoon, A Company, the 1st Battalion of the 242nd Infantry Regiment of the 42nd Rainbow Division. That division had been reactivated in July of 1943 and had been commanded by General MacArthur during World War I.
So a division with a lot of history behind it.
Yes, it did.
And not that that does you a lot of good when you're up there against an enemy.
No, sir.
What do you remember about heading overseas? You're still a very young man. You've never tasted war before. What kind of things go through your mind when you know that's what you're destined for?
To share this with you, I was married and had a child. He was born when we arrived at Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, prior to going overseas. So I was unable to see him for the first time until I arrived home many months later the next year. Knowing that I was headed into combat with a group of men who really I had just a few months' experience getting acquainted with, we were not combat trained, neither were we that close to one another, because a short period of time had elapsed between the time I was assigned to the organization until such time as we were on our way overseas.
Well, and the very fact that you were assigned to that group was because this was an urgent situation. They needed more infantry people, so you were all kind of just thrown together at
the last minute. Exactly.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot of things that could give you comfort or make you feel like you're in a secure and safe situation.
No, I should say that the young man that was assigned to me as an ammo bearer, I lost sight of shortly after we got into combat. I don't know what happened to him. I know he wasn't injured. He may have just taken off. I have no idea what occurred to him. He was from New York, a young kid, about 2 years younger than I was at that time.
And when I hear you say that, I think a lot of people at home probably hear you say that and say, well, you were on your own.
Definitely.
And in a lot of ways, you were on your own. But I know you also felt like you weren't really on your own,
exactly.
That somebody's looking out for you.
I was accompanied by the angels of mercy and the gift of the power of the Holy Spirit through being born again as a Christian before I even entered the service during World War II.
And I know we're going to flesh a lot more of that out as this story continues through the rest of the program today. Let me ask you, your first taste of combat, how did that impact you? Did you feel like you were prepared for it? Was it not too jarring, or was it something that just turned your world upside down?
The latter is correct. There is no way to visualize or to rationalize in your mind what might be taking place. Fear sets in. You're constantly afraid. But then again, I was not afraid. It just seemed like I was accompanied by angels of mercy through the whole ordeal. This happened before Christmas of 1944, just south of the city of Strasbourg in France. We had landed the 8th of December at Marseille and rode 48 boxcars, up to near the line, and were dropped off above Strasbourg, but trucked back south, because at that time, von Rundstedt of the German army was tasked with retaking the city of Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm. And Strasbourg would be a very familiar spot for you later in your life, and
yes,
certainly one that's been scarred in your memory because of what you experienced there. What was the biggest thing that got your attention when you did get into combat? What was maybe the most unexpected thing or the aspect of it that was most difficult for you to deal with?
I don't believe you ever get adjusted to the sounds. I heard tanks, American and German tanks. It wasn't long before I could differentiate which was which. I heard machine gun fire. I could soon tell which side it was coming from. I heard mortar fire. You could soon identify which side was firing the mortars. And artillery fire is entirely different as well. There's nothing like being on the receiving end of enemy artillery. They come in like just a high-pitched scream before they land near, or you don't hear the one that's going to hit you, which fortunately never happened to me.
But you did have some hit pretty near you, and when you see one land just a few feet in front of you, kind of gets your attention, doesn't it?
Definitely. Without question, it does.
And I know you've got some stories about that, some stories about being hit by German machine gun fire, and some stories that I think a lot of you at home today will really be touched and impacted by today. Glenn Schmidt, a former prisoner of war, a U.S. Army veteran of World War II, and a U.S. Air Force veteran in the years since, is our guest today. We're going to take a short break, come back, and get more of Glenn's story. You won't want to miss it. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to continue with Glenn Schmidt of Folsom, California, originally out of Reedley, just southeast of the city of Fresno. Glenn is a World War II veteran who served in the Air Force after World War II, but you heard him tell you that he was with the 42nd Rainbow Division as a BAR man, wielding a Browning automatic rifle in Europe during World War II. I also mentioned that he was a prisoner of war, so we're going to get the story of how he was captured. But before that, Glenn, why don't you tell me the story of how you ended up with a couple of bullet holes in your helmet?
Well, one night early in January 1945, my squad was selected to reestablish a listening post about a half a mile away from where I had been quartered. We were in the old Maginot Line, which was built by the French prior to World War II to effect fortifications against the Germans who might attack them, which they had years before. These fortifications were right near the Rhine River, just to the west of the river, north and south of the city of Strasbourg, way up and not much south.
And these Germans that you were fighting, now,
yes.
You've told us how you guys were just thrown together from all kinds of different outfits because they needed replacements.
Yes.
The guys you're fighting against hadn't been fighting for the Germans for years on the Russian front. They'd fought in that kind of weather before, the worst
yes.
winter that Europe had ever seen. So when you take all those things into account, it sounds like a bit of a mismatch here.
It really was. We did not realize that the 21st and 25th SS Panzer Divisions infantry, as well as running brand new Mark VI Tiger tanks, many of them flame-throwing tanks. This is what we were up against, although we did not realize it. My outfit replaced the 79th Division, which had been on the line for some time. They had pushed the Germans back across the Rhine, and at this time, the 1st of January 1945, this group had just recently come down from the Russian-Finnish border and grouped along the river and crossed it unknown to us.
So it was a bit of a surprise situation when
yes.
you guys were fired upon.
Yes. Well, the night of the 8th of January, when we were selected to reestablish a listening post, we didn't know where we were going. However, 10 or 12 of us, I don't recall exact number, because some of our men had been taken out at Christmas time to be as replacements to the 90th Division, which had lost quite a number of men. It so happened that 90th Division was
your
along
brother
the line
was in
my,
that division.
My brother was a replacement to that division also. Yes. And of course, I did not know that he was overseas until I returned home. He didn't know I was a prisoner until I returned home.
But this night that you're fired on,
Yes.
You guys are in your olive drab, which is easy to spot against the snow, if there's any kind of illumination. The Germans are in all white, even with white sheets over their head?
They used pillowcases on their helmets and either had white capes on, and their boots were whitewashed as well. Very difficult to see at night and almost impossible to see during the day unless they moved.
Tell me about the moment that you realized you were under attack.
Well, we were to establish a listening post where some of our men had been hit and driven back several hours before during the daylight hours. This was well after dark. I don't recall the time, but I estimated it to be about 9 o'clock in the evening. We were crawling along on the open snow with about two and a half feet of snow on the ground and still snowing. And I was crawling with cradling my BAR in my arms. There was one man in front of me. I was the second one, and the balance of the men were behind me. Also at this coming up, taking up the rear was our squad leader as well as our platoon leader. The squad leader was a man by the name of Lentz, and the platoon leader was a man by the name of Jim Beers. However, on the way up, things got very quiet. There had been some scattered firing around us, but not significant enough. And then it just seemed like all hell broke loose. Scattered firing from the right and the left, and way up ahead of us, maybe 75 to 100 yards ahead of us, bullets were flying all around us. And naturally, they used a number of tracers, and I could see the tracers coming right at me, just almost directly at me. And some hit on the snow beside me to my right. I could not tell exactly where they were going, so I turned my head, looked around, and they ricocheted on up into the air above the pillbox that was directly behind us, maybe 300 to 400 yards. At that time, a man by the name of Harold L. Finley from Ohio, the man in front of me, was killed instantly by the machine gun fire. I did not know it at the time. However, he did not move, and after I tried to reach him and tug on him, I saw that he had been killed. Shortly thereafter, two Germans came up on a little wooden bridge about 75 feet in front of us with a machine gun. And as I was able to knock both of them down with my BAR, within a minute, three more came up, and they got the machine gun on firing on automatic. It was bouncing up and down with tracers going everywhere.
It was out of control. They weren't firing. It was firing.
Yes, it was firing, but it was out of control because I had dropped those other three men as well.
So even while you're under fire and your friend is killed, you're doing your part, you're doing your job, you're taking out these Germans, but this uncontrolled German machine gun is still firing bullets, and they're heading your way.
Yes, they were. And since then, I have taken my family back there, and the railing on this little bridge still has bullet holes in it. It was made out of angle iron, mm-hmm. and their bullet impacts and holes still in that in the railing over that bridge.
And that's all your fault.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's all my fault.
I think the statute of limitations is up. I don't think the bridge owners are going to come after you.
No, sir.
But speaking of bullet holes,
yes.
Shortly thereafter, you ended up with a couple in your helmet. How close did that come to ending your life?
Well, if you could see the helmet, a bullet hole comes in the front and exits the rear, being deflected by the liner that I wore. My helmet was knocked off, and I was wearing a wool knit cap. I lost my cap, and in trying to put another clip in my rifle, I had to take off my gloves because my hands were so cold. I could not take another clip out of my belt and insert it in the rifle. And my hands were so cold, I could not get them around two grenades that I had in my in my field jacket because I was close enough. I thought if I could just toss a grenade in there, I'd be okay under the bridge. I'd be okay because Germans were on both sides of that creek and on a little road to our right, maybe just a few yards from me, that crossed this little wooden bridge that these Germans were up on.
But your hands were so numb, you weren't very confident that you could avoid blowing yourself up with one of those grenades.
Definitely. Yes, sir.
But and you couldn't get your helmet back on your head because the liner had been moved aside by that bullet that better that it move your liner than end your life. But you decided to carry the helmet with you.
Well, I felt it had saved my life once. It might save my life a second time. But when I put it on my head, it wouldn't fit because the straps inside my helmet liner had been lengthened to accommodate a wool knit cap over my head. So the only recourse I had was to carry the helmet back with me, which I did.
And how long was it from that instance to when you were actually captured and that your group of men was surrendered to the Germans?
We held out, according to the presidential unit citation, which our regiment received, we held out for 52 hours. Each time, and all this time, I was helping care for wounded, and I was assisting the best I could. We relinquished all the ammunition that we had, every bit of it, to fellows that were out in foxholes. And when we were finally captured, I had no ammunition at all to fight with.
And that's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
You can't fight without adequate protection. You can't fight off tanks with rifles and machine guns.
And when your group was surrendered to the Germans, you were inside a pillbox?
Yes, sir. I was sitting directly behind my company commander. His name was William A. Corson. He was one brave man in my estimation. Captain Corson was asked by a sergeant, the third platoon sergeant, and by one lieutenant that was with him to surrender because the day before we had seen those Mark VI Tiger tanks fire their flamethrowing ability at the pillboxes on up the line. They could not get to us because of that little wooden bridge. They didn't dare try to cross it. And I had learned that or had been told that it had been blown by our mortar people, but I'm not too sure about that.
So the question they asked Corson was, can we surrender now, right?
Well, yes, sir. At that time, the Germans had blown in the steel door with a Panzerfaust, which was like a Bangalore torpedo or like a heavy explosive that they used against tanks, and blew in the steel door, killed a number of fellows that were immediately on the inside. I was taking care of the wounded. Our company commander had been severely wounded the day before. He lost his right eye. There were shrapnel all over his face, his right side, and his shoulders, clear down on top of him. And when the Germans came up on top and dropped grenades down through the vent holes, it was like sticking your head in the steel drum and somebody pounding on it with a sledge. We had no alternative in order to get out, since we had no ammunition. The sergeant and the lieutenant tried to convince Captain Corson to surrender. Otherwise, they had handheld that they could have thrown in on us, and we'd all been incinerated. However, Captain Corson said, and I'm sitting right behind him, he said, "You can surrender if you want to, but you don't have my permission." That took an awful lot of courage, a lot of guts.
And obviously that stuck with you all these years.
It has.
He had so little regard for his own life.
That's correct.
And so much love for his country, I suppose, and the cause.
If I can make one more comment.
Mm-hmm.
The last transmission that came on our 300 radio from regimental or battalion headquarters, I don't know which, was "Hold the line at all costs." I heard that, and it rang in my ears. I thought to myself, well, I'm part of that cost.
Mm-hmm.
And we all were.
Well, there's a terrific new documentary called Hold at All Costs. It's actually about the Korean War and Outpost Harry within that war. And the way that turned out, a lot of them were part of the cost. And so many stories from World War II have that same thing. But hold at all costs, that's not a very encouraging thing to hear, because that means you ain't coming home. Yes. But you're here talking to me, so we know that you did make it home. And we need to take another break right here. But when we come back, we're going to talk about what kept Glenn going through his time as a prisoner of war, and another close call that he experienced before he was taken prisoner, and the incredible twist that his story took years after World War II. You won't want to miss it. The rest of Hometown Heroes coming right up on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time always goes by fast. We're more than halfway through the program today, so let's get right back to it with Glenn Schmidt, who was a prisoner of war during World War II. You heard about the events leading up to his capture, but I glossed over, Glenn, another close call, and you talked freely about some of the other men you served with. It's clear in the tone of your voice how much respect and esteem and admiration you have for those men and how powerful that still is today. And nothing grabs you more than knowing that someone else paid the price that you could have easily paid. I understand there was another moment where your position was under attack, and where you actually got up to take a position. And if you'd been allowed to do so, you wouldn't be sitting with me here today. Tell me about that.
That's so true. We were, I do not recall the name of the village that we were in, and I don't know if I've ever made mention of this to anyone, but we were going through this village, and as soon as I made a turn in the town, I looked straight ahead, and at the end of the street was a German artillery piece with a couple of soldiers behind it, and I ducked into an office area, ducked in away from a field of fire, and just that instant they fired, and fellas in front of me were completely obliterated.
I can't imagine what that does to you. That the position, was it a tank that you were in where they said, come to the top, Smitty, go to the top, and you started to go, and Smith said, no, I'll go instead?
This particular incident was in the same German pillbox that I was captured in.
Mm-hmm.
That particular day, the platoon sergeant, his name was Al Cahoon, said, Smitty, go on up into the turret and see what's going on, to find out what's taking place. Well, it's like a well that went up to the top of the pillbox with rebar in it to step on, like steps.
And a gun turret at the top.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My friend Bill Smith was told to... he went ahead of me, and he said, Smitty, you're doing a good job taking care of the wounded, and which I was, doing the best of my ability, because we only had one medic with us. His name was Ralph J. Mashad from Northern Maine, and he was the only medic to take care of all the wounded that were coming back in or being brought back in, carried back in. And while I was sitting behind Captain Corson, our company commander, Bill Smith told me, You stay here, I'll go on up. As Bill Smith went, our company commander then decided to go on up behind him. And he said, I'm going to take a look around too. At that time, an 88 that was situated some yards, 100 yards ahead of us, was zeroed in on that turret, probably with an officer, somebody with binoculars, to see if there was any movement. As soon as Bill Smith had... looked out one of the openings of this turret, they fired. Bill Smith came down in just pieces, and that's when our company commander was severely wounded.
And that would have been you.
It would have been me. I wouldn't be talking to you today.
And that really gets your attention,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes. I've since tried to reach the family. Bill Smith's brother was totally deaf, could not hear. I talked to his wife some years ago, and that's about the only communication I have had with them.
And one thing that really strikes me, and I know it's clear with the life that you've lived since, so many veterans who I talked to who had an experience like that where they realized so clearly it could have been them, they are so motivated to live a life that honors that life that did pay that yes. price. And is it fair to say that that's an approach you've taken?
I would say so. It's, you know, you don't often think about those things, but I'm glad for the fact that I have remained alive in a situation that I could give my testimony to others.
And you are certainly a survivor. We're going to hear more about that. But I know I'm skipping around time-wise here. Another thing that strikes me in hearing what I have of your story as a very powerful moment for you, just before this all unfolded, just before you were nearly killed with that bullet and then eventually captured, you got a letter from home.
Yes, sir.
What did your dad have to say to you that really hit home for you?
It's the only letter I can remember in all the time that I was over there that I had received from my father. And my father was not a writer of letters, I can tell you that. He wrote a portion of the 91st Psalm, the 7th verse, where it says, 1,000 shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, and shall not come nigh thee. After I read that letter and we were told to go out on this patrol, I asked the fellows to take off their helmets and bow in a moment of prayer, which we did. I'm so thankful I did at that time because, like I say, or have told, there are some that did not survive.
And obviously that's something that stuck with you and something that really proved true. As they died all around you, you found yes. a way to survive. We talked about your capture, and I know the journey to the prisoner of war camp is a story in itself. I want to get to the conditions inside the camp, but just getting to it was pretty harrowing. Not only are you being marched and taken on trains and transported this way or that, at one point you had a very real fear that you could be killed by your own troops who were firing at your position.
The night we were captured, we were taken to a little town by the name of Buell, B-U-H-L, and lined up in the street. And our artillery was zeroing in on this little village. The church was on fire, and they're trying to set more buildings on fire with white phosphorus shells. And at that time, in two groups, we were separated maybe 20 feet, and an artillery shell came in, landed on that street between our two groups, ricocheted through the fence, and did not explode. Now, that's a miracle in itself.
And it wouldn't have bothered the Germans a whole lot if you guys had been killed.
No, sir.
Obviously, they were leaving you out there for that possibility.
It could have been.
So, again, somebody's looking out for you. Then you get to the prisoner of war camp. And you had gone in, you described carrying around your BAR equipment, and you were strapping 145 pounds. Did you realize after you'd been captured that this starvation was going to set in? Did you realize that you would be so malnourished and fed so little?
Not at all. We had no idea. The Germans told us that the war was over for us and we could relax. But the day we walked into camp, there were approximately 100 of us, and I was up in front of the group because I had been in front of the group for some time without going into that part of the story. A German guard standing at the gate in good English says, "You will live from 5 to 7 months on what you get to eat here." Those weren't very encouraging words. The fellows behind us wanted to know what he said, and none of us would repeat it. But it proved to be quite true.
Well, and of course, at this point, nobody knows when the war is going to end. It's an uncertain future. You don't know what tomorrow is going to hold, but
that's true.
Is certainly unnerving. And then, as you said, it was proven true with the diet that you got. You hear about prisoner of war camps and aid parcels that show up. That didn't happen very often at Stalag 9B, did it?
No, sir. No. In the morning, they brought up, fellas went down to what we called a kitchen and brought up a barrel of ersatz coffee. It was just maybe a little chicory in it. We don't know. It had some color, and that's about it. Most of the fellas just washed in it. I drank it because I wanted something warm inside of me because there's still snow on the ground all over. We were up on a mountaintop southeast of Frankfurt, about 30 miles.
And as far as food, not much of anything. Some bread with a lot of sawdust in it, probably?
Yes. In the evening, a loaf of bread was handed to us to be divided between not less than six, mostly 10 to 12 fellas. I used my pocket knife. We if it was to be divided among six men or whatever, a group was chosen up, and I handed my pocket knife to him, and he cut it up as evenly as he could. The fellow who cut the bread got the last piece.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he cut it as close as he could.
I do understand. I know this was absolutely horrific, and when you were finally liberated, you're only 92 pounds, so people can do the math and see how starvation, what kind of starvation was going on there. But at one point, when you actually did get some food, you got a little taste of home? You actually had fruit bars from the valley?
Yes, sir. The K rations had a fruit bar for breakfast. The breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The breakfast unit had a fruit bar. I guess it was peaches, apricots, raisins, figs, and may have been some other fruit, probably apricots, in a bar, maybe 3.5-4 inches long. And fellas would just give that away, trade it off, which I really like it coming from San Joaquin Valley. It was good for me because it began to clean me out. The reason being is that the luncheon menu had a had a chunk of cheese in it, and that cheese was pretty good too. But if you ate the D bar, we called the D bar, it was a chocolate bar in the evening, you had to have the fruit bar in the morning to clean you out.
I think everybody knows where you're going, and the details are just horrific of everything you had to endure. But you did, you're here, and we're going to hear more about that when we come back. And I've got a little surprise for you when we come back. We'll come down the home stretch with Glenn Schmidt next. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Check, check, check. In 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Unfortunately, we're very short on time, so we're going to cruise right along with Glenn Schmidt. And I have a surprise guest for him. Joining us on the line from Wichita, Kansas, is Dr. Bill Paschal, who, like Glenn, was a prisoner at Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany during World War II. And these two did not know each other at the time, at least not by name. But Dr. Paschal, can you tell us quickly how you became aware of this gentleman named Glenn Schmidt and the powerful first impression that he made on you?
Yes, I sure can, Paul. Glenn is actually a lifesaver. We were in the prison camp Bad Orb, Germany, and things were pretty grim. We'd witnessed some brutality to our man of confidence. We had been lined up in the yard with the guards facing us with machine guns. The food was almost non-existent. Recreation facilities were nothing. The building that we were in was a thin board roof and upper part of the walls. When it snowed outside, it snowed inside. And actually, a lot of the men in this building that I was in, there were 3,000 Americans, but there were 300 men in the barracks I was in. A lot of the men gave up hope, and they thought that it was a question of not when they would get liberated, but how long they could survive in this environment. Some of these men turned their face to the wall and didn't communicate with the rest of us. They kind of daydreamed the day away, and sure enough, they became the first to pass away or die. One night, there was a big, strong voice came out and said, "I shall recite to you the 23rd Psalm," and this voice began to do that. There was quite a few, non-believers in the crowd. There was quite a few boos and catcalls, but this strong voice recited the 23rd Psalm and some other things from the New Testament, sang some songs, and it was almost like a miracle that barracks became very, very quiet and attentive. You could hear a pin drop. This voice kept this up night after night. And so the lights were out. 300 men crowded there. I couldn't put a face to it. During the daytime, I spent 3 or 4 days. I wandered through the crowd of people that were in our barracks, talking to different people. And I would excuse myself and go on and talk to another person. Finally, I located the owner of that voice, and that was Glenn Smith of the 42nd Infantry Division.
And he's sitting here right now, and he just heard everything you said. And he's got a little water in his eyes after hearing it. Dr. Pascoe, thank you. I know Glenn wouldn't have told us that story himself. Thank you for coming on and sharing it. Thank you for serving our country. And if you're up for it, I'd like to have you on for a full program one of these days.
Okay, that's fine. You bet.
God bless you, Bill.
You bet, Glenn.
So good to hear from you.
Yes.
I know you two share a very special bond. And,
yes, we do.
And I'll be back in touch with you, Dr. Pascoe. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, you bet.
All right, that's Bill Pascoe from Wichita, Kansas, surprising Glenn Schmidt with that little story. And I know for you at home, that probably grabbed your attention the way it grabbed mine. Glenn, I think the question everyone asks is, why? What possessed you to take that kind of role and try to encourage all these other men? Why? What made that possible, and why did you do that?
Well, it was a period of desperation for us all. And I felt that if we didn't group together and try to hold the line ourselves, we would see the end like many others did. I'm just grateful to my Heavenly Father for giving me the inspiration to do that. Yeah, it's nothing in me. It's God alone.
And when the Germans took you captive, you left your helmet behind in that pillbox, but they let you take three things?
Yes, my pocket knife, my wedding ring, and my New Testament. And that New Testament went around our barracks from every day. We had Bible study, we had prayer time together, and I'm so thankful for it.
And obviously, from what we heard from Dr. Pascoe, there are a lot of other POWs who are pretty thankful for it, too. Now, you're slowly starving to death. You have no idea when liberation is going to come. When it did come, how great of a day was that for you? And did you have enough energy to even enjoy it?
At that time, I was so weak, I had to crawl across the floor, pull myself up either against the wall or against a pillar supporting the building in order to stand. And it was very difficult to walk at that time.
Did you, when that happened, did that feel like an answer to prayer for you?
Yes,
it did.
The day before, which was Easter Sunday, 1st of April, 1945, some of us went outside. I asked the fellows if they'd like to go out for a little time of prayer, which we did. We heard machine gun fire coming up out of the valley below us, and we went back into the barracks that night, not knowing that all the guards were going to either leave or surrender the next day.
Was it almost too good to be true?
Yes, it was. It was a day of not only liberation, but a day of elation.
I've heard so many POWs say that once they actually got real food, they ate a little too much and got sick. How about you? Did you have more common sense?
I had more common sense. I really didn't realize I did. It took me all day, once we got some food, to eat two cans of sea rations. All day to eat the two cans. One can had either ham and eggs or spaghetti and meatballs or something like that. The other can had two dry biscuits, some cigarettes, toilet paper, chewing gum, bit of candy, and some instant coffee or orange drink.
And to a lot of people, that sounds pretty mundane. But to you, that was a feast for a king, right?
Amen. Absolutely. You bet.
You know, we're running out of time, and I know there's so much we haven't covered. But I mentioned earlier that you were an Army veteran of World War II, but also an Air Force veteran. Glenn went back into the Air Force, retired as a major. And in the early 1960s, you were stationed in Strasbourg. If people have been listening closely, they know that's very close to that pillbox where you had been captured and where you left your helmet.
One Sunday afternoon, I took my whole family through area that I had fought through. We couldn't naturally cover it all, but we went back to the little town of Hatton where I was captured.
And you had your two sons with you?
Yes, I did.
And they wanted to go in the pillbox?
There were signs all around in English, French, and German to keep out because of the high impact of shells in that area.
But they went in anyway?
They went down inside. Naturally, you know, teenagers, they do not obey all your commands. Anyways, one came out with a grenade. My youngest came out with a grenade, and my oldest came out with my steel helmet, had been there for 17 years.
Could you believe it?
No, sir. At the first, I couldn't. But when I examined it real closely, it had the PFC stripe painted off-center and had my name in white on the inside,
and
my last name.
And those two bullet holes were a pretty good sign, too.
Definitely. Well, naturally, I recognized that immediately.
And I know that sounds hard to believe, that 17 years later it would still be there, but it was. Glenn has the helmet to prove it, and if you'd like to see a picture of that, I'm going to post one on our website, kmjnow.com. And it's just an incredible story that Glenn has shared. We've only gotten some pieces of it, but I think you can tell what an incredible life that he's led, and he's still leading. Glenn, in closing here, is there one thing that your experience, and so many close calls, seeing so many other men pay the ultimate price for our freedom and come so close to doing that yourself, with everything you've been through, what's the most important thing that those experiences have taught you?
The motto of the ex-prisoners of war is freedom is not free. I see that in, even today. There are men giving their lives for their country. We always have. Throughout, when men are called upon, men and women today, are called upon to sacrifice for their country, they seem to do it willingly. And that price that they pay is the ultimate price that anyone could pay with their life. I am deeply gratified for my God and my country.
And I don't blame you. And we are very thankful that not just that you served our country, that you were willing to pay that price if need be, but that you're willing to share with us about it today. Thank you so much, Glenn, and God bless you.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure indeed. We're out of time on the program today, but thanks so much for listening. Again, more about Glenn Schmidt on our website at kmjnow.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.